Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, I'm Ross Kemp. Over the last 18 years, I've made some 90-odd documentaries, predominantly in hostile environments, from Afghanistan to Syria, from El Salvador to the Congo. And it's fair to say that during that time, I found myself in a few interesting situations. I've been shot at, tear gassed, had knives pulled on me, and spears thrown at me. But in all those years, what's impressed me the most is the resilience of the human spirit. Our ability, no matter where we're from, to overcome and make it through to the other side. So, in my new series, The Kempcast, I'll be talking to some incredible individuals who all have engaging stories to tell and have themselves overcome some extremely tough moments in their lives. Right now, we are living in unprecedented times, and we should be doing all we can together to get through this as safely as possible. I hope that if you subscribe to the Kempcast and hear how my guests overcame their toughest moments, it may help you overcome yours, whether you're going through one right now or you're faced with one in the future. Joining me today is Professor David Nutt, a scientist and former drug government advisor who now campaigns to highlight the dangers of alcohol consumption. In this episode, you'll find out why he put me off my routine evening glass of wine. But I still hope you enjoy listening. Professor David Nutt, you're allowing me to call you Dave, but I could also call you a neuropsychopharmacologist. Did you make that name up?
Yeah, I used to be a psychopharmacologist, and then I moved to Imperial College 10 years ago, and they said, well, we want you to study the brain as well as the psyche, so I call myself a neuropsychopharmacologist.
Can you just tell me how many qualifications you have? I've got a few behind us. You're a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians, the Royal College of Psychiatrists, and the Academy of Medical Science. You hold visiting professorships in Australia, New Zealand, and the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that enough?
No, well, I don't know. You probably have got more, haven't you?
Oh, I got a few lesser degrees. That's right.
How did it start?
It started actually with alcohol. In the book, I talk about my very first day as a medical student. And you know, there are nine of us at college, down in College, Cambridge. What do? When you get together, you know, what we did then back in 1969 is what you do now. You go out for a drink. And by the end of the evening, one of the guys was in a state of terrible turmoil. So much, I said, should we call an ambulance? He's going to kill himself. And one of the other guys who knew him from another school said, no, he's always like that when he's drunk. And I thought, hang on. So we've been out drinking, an illegal drug, and it turns this man into
a sobbing mess.
Something, a completely different person. I thought, well, that's interesting. Drugs in the brain, you know, that this is, drugs are a way of probing brain function. You know, it's elicited, brought out in him something which I guess was always there, but would have been hidden.
So is that what drugs do then? They open gateways inside our brains.
Yeah, well, I mean, all brains are basically chemical machines. I mean, yeah, they've got a lot of neurons, which are electrical machines, but the neurons are forced to connect with each other through chemicals.
Chemicals that the body produces.
Yeah, the nerves produce chemicals. For each nerve to talk to another nerve, you've got to release a chemical. And there are 80 different chemicals in the brain. And every drug we know that we use, with possible exception of people who shouldn't ever use this drug, which is butane, for the gas. But other drugs, they all work on the different neurotransmitters.
So when I drink, what does it do to my brain? When I drink alcohol?
Yes. So what happens is that as the alcohol gets into your brain, it starts to turn on some systems in your brain. And the reason we like to drink for most people is it relaxes us. And that is due to the enhanced effect of the brain's relaxing transmitter called GABA. GABA calms you down. Alcohol boosts GABA, calms you down. Then as you drink a bit more, you start to release a bit of dopamine. Now, dopamine is the transmitter that drugs like stimulants, cocaine work on.
Is it a reward stimulant?
It's part one of them. Well, that's not just what it does. What it does more actually than reward is motivate and driving. People get activated and animated.
Switched on,
yeah. So alcohol releases a bit of dopamine, not as much as cocaine, but enough to make you enjoy it enough to make you feel part of life. And then as you push it up a bit more, you start to release endorphins, which are they calm you down. Endorphins.
So endorphins calm you down.
Endorphins are like heroin. You know, they sort of put you in a slightly, they give you euphoria, and they make you high. The runner's high used to be thought to be due to endorphins. It probably is to some extent. So that's a sort of positive feeling. And then as you keep pushing those, you get a bit of serotonin released. Serotonin, a bit like ecstasy. You know, you start to love each other, you know, become more concerned.
It's all sounding good so far.
It is. And then you get to a level, which is about, when you get over about twice the drink driving limit, then you get into that's where the trouble starts, because then you start to block neurotransmitters.
And your body does this because what
your alcohol does. No, the alcohol blocks it.
So it stops you transmit your brain functioning.
Yeah, and that's where you start to forget things, because it blocks a transmitter called glutamate, which makes you remember. So then you get blackouts. And of course, if you keep pushing it up and up, you dampen your brain down. Alcohol is an anesthetic, and eventually it'll calm your brain down. It'll block transmission to a point where you stop breathing and die.
So that's the true ending of alcoholic poisoning is actually if you die.
You usually die of respiratory distress.
You stop sending messages to your heart and to your lungs
to
breathe.
That's right. Yeah. And about 3 young people a week die just of alcohol poisoning in this country.
3 young people?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There is one thing that I did read in the book, and I think it's very interesting. You said you try and buy an 18th birthday card or a 21st birthday card that does not have some reference to alcohol in it, and it's quite difficult. It's champagne corks, it's beers, it's let's get pie-eyed, whatever it is.
It's so difficult. So I set myself that challenge once, and I didn't realize how difficult it was, because I was determined I was not going to send a card encouraging drinking.
You're an expert on, as you say, on the effects that drugs have on human beings. And did you say that you've actually probably, there's not many people alive that have given so many different drugs to so many different people?
Old, so I've had plenty of time to do research. I reckon I've probably given more different kinds of drugs to human beings than anyone I know alive.
Yeah. Why do you say that alcohol is the worst drug out there?
So in the UK, alcohol is the most harmful drug to the UK, because it's so widely used. It's not the most harmful drug to the user. I mean, you know, if you, there are other drugs which are going to be more dangerous. I mean, heroin, fentanyl, crack cocaine, spice, they're more harmful to you as a user. But thankfully, they're not widely used. But alcohol is so widely used that I bet every family in the country is affected one way or the other by alcohol, either through someone drinking too much or someone being damaged by a drunk driver or getting into a fight or something.
And it's legal, of course.
And it is absolutely legal, and pretty much every other drug isn't. So the only drug you can use to relax yourself or to enjoy a social occasion that's legal is alcohol. And that's wrong, I think.
You'd say now, if it was invented today, it would be declared an illegal drug.
It would be if we applied the same criteria as we currently apply. That's right.
And would it be Class C?
No, it would be probably B.
It'd be a
Class B drug, yes. It's on the threshold of A and B in terms of the harm to the user. Yeah.
But it's also about the cost, not only to the individual, but to the country as a whole. Yes. But also it's a big generator of finance for governments, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So this is the card that the alcohol industry plays all the time. It says, look, you know, we contribute 20 billion in taxes and we provide a lot of jobs. And that is true. But then on the other side of the equation, you know, it's 3.5 billion in healthcare costs, 6.5 billion in policing costs, 20 billion in lost production from hangovers and things. So the net balance is all, it's a debt.
It's a debt that approaches around 20 billion pounds.
That's right. So all taxpayers are paying that much in order to allow them to do what they do, which is to drink as they want to drink. And I always think it's a bit hard on those people who don't drink at all because they're forced to pay their taxes and subsidise the drinking of those who do.
I did a documentary about alcohol, and I think we were definitely put under pressure to an extent to not be as damning as we could have been. And I am a drinker. I mean, I'll put my hands
up. So am I.
You know, it is my drug of choice. And I love red wine. And I used to be a member of rugby clubs or many rugby clubs, and watering can would come around and you'd have no idea exactly how much you had consumed until I'd definitely gone past what the fifth or the sixth stage.
Yeah.
And you saw the effects it could have on people on a Saturday night. If you started drinking after a game about 4:30, there are people still in there at 11 o'clock at night in a very different state to the one that they started it in.
Yeah. Well, so a couple of important messages there. Two I'm making the book. The first is never drink to hydrate. You know, drinking after sports is fun, but people often drink too much because they're trying to rehydrate themselves. So don't use even beer, even relatively weak beer, don't use that to rehydrate after sport. Always rehydrate first and then drink. And the second is actually sort of count what you're drinking and never allow someone to fill your glass when it's not empty.
So you give me the Ross Kemp guide to drinking, please. Or your actual guide to drinking, but the way I should behave when I go out. So if I want to avoid a cracking hangover, poisoning myself, giving myself everything from Alzheimer's to cancer to cirrhosis.
Right. So decide what risks you want to take with your drinking, okay? So let's assume,
it already sounds too risky.
You don't have to drink at all then. You
know, I probably am going to because there's so much social pressure put on people. And also, I quite like it.
So that's the really interesting thing about alcohol, unlike, say, tobacco, is that the relationship between consumption and harm is it's not straight. It goes up like a very steep mountain once you get over about a bottle of wine a day. So the first message would be absolutely clear to anyone, never drink more than a bottle of wine a day. I was signing some books at the Barbican on Sunday, and a guy came up to me and he said,
I've been drinking 2 bottles of claret since I was 12.
He said, I never drink more than 1 bottle of wine at lunch. That's not quite
it. Depends how often you lunch, doesn't it, I guess?
Yeah. So,
go on.
Ideally, if you stick to the government recommended limits, of which are 14 units.
Can we just be real? Let's just break that down because a unit is such a what is a unit?
8 grams, there you go.
That'd be handy. I carry my scales around with me.
Yes, sure. I know, it's...
Probably get arrested for being a dealer if I did. Go on. So,
we'll just keep
on
coming.
How do you... I mean, so quantify what...
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, depending on what you're doing, but it's worth knowing. Yeah, this is an important point. It's worth having an idea of what you are drinking. So one of the key messages is try to work out what you are drinking. Try to remember. Keep a diary for a week and just see what you are drinking.
Yeah.
And then see where you are in relation to the 14 years.
Everybody lies. I mean, doctors, all GPs, when I spoke to GPs, when he made a documentary, he said, we look at what someone fills in and then we times it by 4 or 5 because people always lie.
This is why this is about you doing this for yourself.
Right.
If you're going to lie to yourself, well, can't we just forget it, you know. But if you actually are serious in thinking about your drinking, then keep a proper diary. That's the first thing. And the second thing is to look at the drinks you drink and see which of those were really worthwhile and which of them were just habit. And then get rid of the habit ones. Because I believe that having an estimate of what you drink, you should know that pretty reasonably. It's like knowing how heavy you are, or what your blood pressure is, or what your cholesterol is. Now you know those things. So I think if everyone could be relatively clear as to what they're drinking, that'll help them make sensible decisions.
I mean, I summed up the film that we made, which two or three years ago. But, you know, if we all basically drank a little bit less, we'd all live a little bit longer. Correct. And probably be a little bit more happier across the board. Because you are causing, we're causing the pain and distress that you eventually cause. Hangovers.
Yeah, quite.
I mean, the anger that that can cause inside a family unit, you know, absolutely. You just sort of, yeah. I mean, as you say, carry on. Give me my rules for drinking. So if I go out for an evening, I read some of them. One was by the third round, for instance, because you can make that, if you're buying, you can make that a non-alcoholic drink.
Exactly, that's quite a clever trick,
but,
yeah.
But you'll probably get peer pressure, particularly at a certain age, that you are wimping out or you're not a true man or you're not part of the party or whatever.
The point
about buying
the third round is that you don't tell them.
Right. They don't drink beers.
They don't know what you're... Yes. Yeah. You're getting the round in, so you're, this is yours, and this is mine. What you're drinking...
And another one is, which I sort of thought was counterintuitive, but obviously you know what you're talking about. I don't. A pint of beer before you start on the wine to fill you up.
Yes. Well, that's what I do.
Well, is that because you like beer and then wine, or is it because there is actually some science
behind...
I like both. But is there science behind that?
Well, only that, the more... Full your stomach. I mean, you'd have to drink beer. You can drink a pint of water.
Water, yeah.
But on the other hand, you don't get into the party spirit drinking a pint
of water.
No,
that's right.
So it's just... But don't drink strong beer. Don't drink, 8% IPA. Yeah.
That's what people do, though. And there's a massive movement towards
that. Although, to be fair, they're serving the stronger beers in smaller amounts now.
Yeah.
So just be aware of that. The reason it's they only serve them at half pints is because they're twice as strong.
But France... Dave, if I may, had a massive issue with alcohol, and they managed to kind of implement structures that changed that from advertising to just like social. It was seen to be socially incorrect. Correct. To get absolutely smashed. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's still so, why is it so prevalent in British culture? Is it part of the way our makeup, or is it just we just haven't caught up with everybody else yet?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to say several things. The first is, the French did instigate wonderful rational policies to reduce the consumption. So 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the French were drinking three times what we were. And they were dying with liver disease at rates which are six times ours. They have reduced consumption through a number of ways, through pricing, through reducing the drink driving limit and through stopping advertising. And it's been remarkable. So they've reduced their consumption. So now we drink more than them.
A lot more than them?
We drink not a lot more, but we've doubled our consumption and they've reduced their consumption to a third. So our paths have crossed.
Why is that?
And that's because they've done the right things and we haven't. So, we still have alcohol advertising. The French don't. And people say, well, we've got to have alcohol advertising, or so we'll never win the World Cup at football. And I say, well, the French seem to manage it.
More frequently than we have.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the first thing. The French approach was, and it was driven by a scientist, Pierre Roche, who I knew when I was younger. And, it was a scientific-driven approach. What we've done is we've allowed the drinks industry to dominate our policies. And the big increase in harms in alcohol in Britain has come from people buying booze in supermarkets and drinking at home.
Yeah, it's drinking behind closed doors. When there were pubs, there was a landlord and he was there for a reason. And also, if you got drunk continuously in that pub, you were no longer welcome, not only by the landlord, but also by your fellow drinkers.
That's right.
It was socially unacceptable. But if I want to go to Tesco or any other supermarket, let's mention Sainsbury's and all the other ones as well before we get sued, Marks and Spencer's included, I can go and buy a crate of wine, take it home and sit there and carry on opening bottles if I'm on my own with the curtains drawn, until I collapse in a stupor or throw up or kill myself.
Exactly.
There are no rules. No. And also, you're encouraged to buy two for one or three for one.
Yes, well, they should. So that's an interesting point, and I completely support what you're saying. And the Scots, of course, have confronted this.
With
the minimum pricing.
Yeah, let's explain that.
So the Scots have now achieved this unwelcome record of having the worst levels of cirrhosis in the world. Actually, interestingly, not because of the heaviest drinkers. The Russians are way the heaviest drinkers, but the Russians drink so much they don't even live long enough to get cirrhosis. They just die of alcohol poisoning. Half of all Russian men die of alcohol
50%.
50% of Russian men. Anyway, put that to one side. The Scots are now got the highest levels of cirrhosis in the world, up to 40% of all their intensive care beds.
40%?
40%. Up to 40% of all their intensive care beds are occupied by people who are dying of alcohol-related disorder, like cirrhosis. And 8 years ago, they decided to do something about it, and they decided to do minimum unit pricing.
So, i.e., it's pricing a unit of alcohol at 50 pence.
Yes, or some acceptable level.
Yeah, which was obviously not going to be welcomed by the alcohol industry, because because the lower you price alcohol, the more you're going to sell, right?
Well, it's complicated. It's complicated.
Uncomplicate it for me.
So, the interesting thing about the French experiment we just talked about was that they priced out cheap booze. They priced out cheap booze by a kind of minimum pricing. They made all French wine a proper controlled quality wine. That's more profitable. The French drink less wine, but their wine industry makes more profit.
Because it's priced higher, yeah?
Exactly. Now, the drinks industry in Britain know this is true. They know that minimum unit pricing would actually probably make them more money. But they've opposed it. Simply because they don't want to give any concession to the anti-drink lobbyist. So what they say is, oh, look, 50p a unit, that's punishing the responsible drinker like you. And I say to you, I bet you don't buy any booze. That's less than 50p a unit.
They were drinking, we were looking at alcohol amongst young people, and they were drinking Frosty Jack, which is a very, very... strong cider that you could buy in shops for absolutely nothing, like 50 pence for a litre, something like that, £2 for a litre, less than that. And I met a guy who had once been a psychiatric nurse that ended up living in a cupboard that was drinking 25 to 30 litres of cider a day. Mm-hmm. Why are we allowed to encourage people to buy alcohol that cheaply when we know that potentially not only is it harmful to them, it's harmful to other people around them? And also leads on to doing other things.
And the reason that it's because the drinks industry has a principle, which is that people should drink. Now, they don't care what they drink as long as they drink, because the more alcohol sold, the more people are drinking, the more people are addicted to alcohol, the more they're going to buy booze. So the Scots have done the thing about 50p minimum unit pricing is that it takes out the cheap ciders, the Frosty Jacks, takes out the young people drinking, and it also reduces consumption in the alcoholics, the very severe end, the ones that are going into intensive care. Mm. If you reduce their consumption by 10%, you actually reduce the health risks by over 30% because of the very steep curve.
So the cost to the National Health Service or whatever it may be, you're reducing that dramatically.
Yeah, because you take someone out of intensive care.
But it's not just that, is it? Sorry, it's not just that, is it? Yeah. It's policing. It's not just the actual cost of a bed. It's having those extra nurses. It's also having to have police in casualty to protect staff.
Exactly.
It's also just, you know, the random accidents that happen,
precisely.
You know, not just in cars, but all, you know, from
people don't realize how vulnerable drunk people are, the easiest target.
And it's also sexual exploitation as well.
Too. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, being intoxicated so you don't know what's going on around you makes you very vulnerable.
I was one of the things that I was reading about, you know, the difference between, let's say, marijuana and alcohol. Could you just really clear that one up for me? What's the difference?
You smoke one.
You smoke one.
Sorry.
Yeah, you inhale you can, one. Yeah, yeah. You can ingest it as well, though, couldn't you?
Yeah, but ingesting, yeah, is it, one of the reasons that marijuana is safe is that you do smoke it, paradoxically, because as soon as you stop, as long as you start smoking, it's not going into your body. One of the reasons alcohol is not so safe, you drink a liter of vodka like Amy Winehouse and you can't get rid of it. And it's in there and it's poisoning you. So I was being slightly facetious about smoking cannabis, but there is a safety measure to smoking over ingesting at one level.
What about the actual effect that it has on you neurologically?
Yeah, very, very different. And the main reason cannabis is much, much safer than alcohol is that it does not suppress breathing. In fact, it might even facilitate breathing.
Really?
So, yeah.
So why is it illegal?
Well, it's illegal because it's a relatively recent invention. I mean,
it's not a recent invention. It's a plant that's been around for
yeah, but it
ages.
Yeah, but the actual first emergence of the THC-containing cannabis, what's called the banga came in from India in about 1680. So that's relatively
1680.
Recent. 1680. Yeah. I mean, it's not that recent, but it's...
No, what you're saying is that people actively smoked it to get high because hemp's been in around the world.
Yeah, Henry VIII had a rule that every farm in Britain had to have a field of hemp so you could make canvas for the ships.
Yeah.
But hemp is kind of a dial, so people didn't get high.
There's no THC in hemp?
Well, there's a tiny bit, but you've got to smoke a lot of hemp to get high.
Right.
And people didn't know about smoking in those days because they hadn't invented tobacco. Well, they hadn't brought tobacco in.
Yes.
But cannabis was a medicine until about, it was easily available. People used to use it as a tincture. People used to put it in their tea to deal with their sort of pains and epilepsy and stuff until about the 1880s. And then there was a strong Puritan prohibition movement. They tried to take out all drugs.
There's been a big religious movement historically to kind of stop all things.
That's right.
Alcohol,
absolutely.
Any drugs, anything that has a mind-altering effect.
And they
started
off and they managed to get rid of cannabis and they managed to get rid of codeine to some extent. And then they tried to take on alcohol. And in some countries, in America, they got rid of
prohibition.
Alcohol. But in Britain, they didn't. And since then, the drinks industry has been fighting an extraordinarily efficient battle to keep alcohol, but to make sure none of the other drugs come. So the resistance to cannabis being recreational is to some extent driven by the drinks industry not wanting competition.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. You see in the States where now 11 states have voted for recreational cannabis, you see that the lobby against that is driven largely by the drinks industry.
Yeah, Tilly, if you talk to a police officer, who he'd rather deal with?
Absolutely.
Someone who's stoned or someone who's pissed, paralytic, he's going to go for the stoner every day.
Absolutely. In fact, the police were very positive about legalizing cannabis back in the early 2000s when the committee I was on, the ACMD, we downgraded cannabis from grade A and B to class C.
Then it got pushed back up again, did it?
Yeah, the police were really supportive. And then, Gordon Brown decided he wanted to get votes by being hard on drugs. And so everything went backwards. It was a political decision, not a health decision. And then the police changed because they started incentivizing the police to arrest people for cannabis. And suddenly the police hate cannabis. Even though, as you say, they know it's much easier to deal with someone. Absolutely. Yeah.
Is it a gateway drug, cannabis?
No, it's not a gateway drug.
By that I mean, does it lead you on to taking stronger substances or other substances that are classified higher in the alphabet?
No. It's not a gateway drug unless you sell it the way we sell it. So if you sell it in the back streets where your dealer would always offer you, you know, 3 for $2, here, have your cannabis, but here's a bit of crack, here's a little bit of H, it's a gateway drug. Whereas in the Netherlands, it's not a gateway drug. And the reason the Dutch set up the coffee shops 40 years ago was explicitly to separate the cannabis market, which they knew their kids were going to use anyway, from the hard drugs. And they said, our kids are going to get the cannabis and will never meet a dealer. And they never meet a dealer, and they have virtually no use of heroin in their young people.
But if you go back to what was called the British system.
That's right.
Which was opposite of the American system. But the British system was to treat people who were addicts as medical.
As human beings.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but also as people with a medical issue, a medical problem that could be dealt with a GP, not with a police officer.
Absolutely.
Not by putting them into prison.
And do you know why it changed? It changed in 1971 explicitly because of pressure from the US to conform to their philosophy. And we see it all along. I was just talking with my colleague on the way here today. The big battle going on over vaping, e-cigarettes. The Americans want to eliminate e-cigarettes, even though they don't want to eliminate cigarettes. And they're putting huge pressure on British authorities to ban e-cigarettes.
Because they grow so much tobacco in the United States of America?
You could say. That's possibly part of the reason, but it's more, I think, that their whole philosophy is about banning rather than harm reduction. So, as you said, in 1971, there were 1,000 heroin addicts in Britain, mostly in London, getting prescribed heroin.
So,
the Americans said, you've got to stop prescribing, it contravenes the UN conventions. So we stopped because all our drug laws have been made at their behest. And in 20 years, we went from 1,000 addicts to 200,000 addicts. Why? Because every addict has to generate 25 new addicts to buy enough heroin from them to pay for their own habit.
Right. So when it was prescribed and it was at virtually free, there wasn't the crime attached to it, so therefore there wasn't the issue and there wasn't the explosion of addicts. I mean,
and worse than
people
that,
people will say that's a very oversimplistic way of looking at the explosion of the use of heroin and other drugs, but I am, you know, if you go back even earlier than that, and if you go back to the 50s, there was something like 300 heroin addicts that were actually of note in this country.
That's right.
Where we are now, if you look at prisons, I think 50% of all people in prison are either doing time because of drugs or being associated.
That's right. The doubling of our prison population in the last 40 years is all driven by drug crime, supposed drug crime. And you look at Portugal, which has actually emptied its prisons because it's decriminalized drug use and treats it as a medical problem. I mean, but all decisions that have been made in this country for the last 50 years.
Are they all financial?
They're all political. They're not financial. No. The most expensive way of dealing with drugs is to put people in prison.
Absolutely. It's £40,000. Look at every prisoner in the UK is £40,000 on your tax every year.
Absolutely. And then there's all the testing equipment for their drugs. No, it's the most expensive way. It's the most irrational way. We do it because we just like to punish people.
Do you think that's true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's our politicians are all embedded in this. Make someone an object of hate make them despicable. Get people to vote. You know, people who don't vote, drug addicts don't vote. So it doesn't matter what you do with them, even if it costs money. Someone's suffering. You know, all the decisions have been political. It's actually very distressing to watch that.
You have very famously falling out with those politicians. Right. Someone might say there's no one here to defend them, so I will do my best, though I'm not sure I agree necessarily with some of the views that have been taken by our politicians over the years. You were an advisor to the government for a number of years on drugs and alcohol.
10 years. Well, they wouldn't let us advise on alcohol. They said it wasn't a drug.
But you were part of a committee, but didn't David Cameron make sure that it was 50% people in the drink industry and 50% academics and people who might not be pro the drink industry? So that leaves you with no majority either way.
Well, we thought it was what's called a conflict of interest.
But I'm trying to say
the drinks industry on the committee.
So I work for, I don't know, Pernod or Diageo, one of the big alcohol selling companies, and you're an academic that's saying that people should moderate what I sell. It's not going to work, is it?
It didn't work, and the academics all resigned. Yeah,
they all resigned.
They all resigned. Yeah, the committee's been disbanded because it cannot work. So you gave an example earlier on. You didn't in relation. The only decision that the drinks industry would agree with in terms of messaging about harm was to say, drink responsibly. And as we all know, mostly that's why we drink, to lose responsibility.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Why did the government ask you to resign, Dave?
Well, they asked me to resign because I said alcohol was the most harmful drug in Britain, and they did not.
What about the equine ecstasy?
Oh, I got it. Okay, so let's.
No. But let's talk about it.
It's a great story. So, So I had two big fall-ins with the government. The one I've just talked about
fall
earlier.
Fallouts or fall-ins?
Fallouts, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, no, it's all right. You're allowed. You fell in with them first, then you fell out with them.
Fell out with them, that's right. So the second one was when I said alcohol was the most biggest problem and we should be controlling it, thinking about controlling it under the Misuse of Drugs Act. But the first one was about ecstasy. And this was when Jackie Smith was the Home Secretary. And the Labour government did not want to review the harms, the class of ecstasy. Ecstasy was put into Class A back in the 1980s.
After the death of Leah Betts, was
yeah,
it?
Around about that time, yeah. And the government did not want to review it because they knew it shouldn't be Class A. It wasn't that harmful, right?
Well, if people were dying of it, why was it not harmful?
Well, very few people were dying of it. I mean, you know.
That subsequently, and we've researched this, has gone up significantly.
Well, that's a different question. I'll tell you, I'll come back to why that's happened. That is the increase in deaths from ecstasy is a direct and predictable response to current policy.
Classing it at A. But what about for you personally? We talk about toughest moments in your life. Can you tell me what's been the toughest moment in your life?
Well, certainly being sacked by Alan Johnson. That was a pretty disturbing experience. Least of all because it came through in an email just before I was about to give a lecture. You're sacked.
but why did it? Why did that? Of all the things that have happened in your life, all the personal things that happened in your life, why was that? Why did that?
Well, because I spent 10 years trying to make this country a better place by improving understanding of drug harms and improving the drug laws. I'd worked my butt off to try to get it right. And I was being sacked just for what I thought was just kind of trivial reason, which was that I just disagreed with him. And it just seemed completely inappropriate.
Was it him or was it advisors to him?
It's a great story. So, well, of course, it was almost every decision was made by Gordon Brown. And there was a peculiar coming together of the fates that weekend because the science minister was in Japan racing his classic racing car. So he wasn't informed.
And that sounds very New Labour.
Yeah, well, he was very rich. He was that kind of New Labour. Yes, he had a Lola, by the way. And so he was in Japan. And then it is a bit odd for a minister to be doing that sort of thing, isn't it? But never mind. He was in the House of Lords. And the chief scientist, who was actually a friend of mine, David Bennington from Imperial College, he was in Uzbekistan that weekend. And he rang me before I got sacked saying, are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm all right. I thought, why is he ringing me? He said, look, I'm going to be in Uzbekistan. I won't have any phone contact. So you're sure you're all right? I said, yeah, I'm fine. What's that, you know?
Why wouldn't I be? Did he have pre-knowledge then?
I kind of think within hindsight, maybe he thought things could go wrong.
Right, okay. Yeah, but carry on. So the minister's away and your friend's away. Yeah. And then what? You get an email, you're sacked.
I got an email saying you're sacked. And I wrote back and said, this is not right. You know, my job is to give you advice and you don't have to take it, but you don't have to sack me for giving you advice. And he said, you're sacked. I just think they thought that we can't control this guy. You know, if he keeps on telling the truth, where is it going to end? he'll start telling us we shouldn't have drug laws next.
What happened with the variant ministers?
Well, I had this very surreal conversation on the Today programme.
Radio 4.
We just done this analysis that has shown that that alcohol was actually the most harmful drug. And one of the interviewers said, well, you're not seriously telling us that LSD is less harmful than alcohol. And I said, of course it is. And of course the world just ended. You know, I mean, hysteria hit. You know, I got phoned up by all the right-wing press. You know, what are you? You know, you're a bloody hippie. You know, you're encouraging our kids. I mean, it was all absurd. And then I...
Did you point out you've done more research into the name possibly may have
Yeah,
done.
I did that, actually. I did.
Did it help? No, not really.
No. And then
they took pictures of your kids, didn't they?
The worst thing of all was after I got sacked, I got this phone call. When I was sitting at, I was just going off the next weekend to give a lecture in Paris, and I got this phone call in the airport, and the guy said, I'm Dave from The Sun. And I said, who? And he said, look, I'm going to tell you that tomorrow we're doing an expose on three of your kids drinking. And I said, well, that's outrageous. You can't do that. And he said, what do you think about it? I said, well, that's just outrageous. And I put the phone down. And then I rang the press complaints people and said, what have they done? And they'd hacked into three of my kids' Facebook accounts. And they'd shown a picture of one of my sons smoking a roll-up and said he was stoned. They took a picture of my 15-year-old daughter pretending to be drunk, but she'd never drunk in her life. It was just a sort of game, you know, pretending to be drunk.
Mm.
And they took a picture of my son who lives in Sweden coming out of a sauna in the snow without any clothes on. I mean, none of it relating to alcohol at all. It's just, you become fair game as soon as you become,
As soon as you put your head above the parapet and say what you think, particularly once you're an expert in that field, then you're fair game if you go against what they want.
Absolutely.
They want. Yeah.
And of course, I started with the Sun and then it got into the Mail and the Mail on Sunday. And actually, to be fair, the Sun took it down after the press complaints people made their complaints. But the Mail didn't. And I said to them, well, why can't you get the Mail to take it down? And they said, well, you got to realize that the Paul Dacre, the editor of the Mail, is the chair of the Press Complaints Authority. At which point I began to think, we don't quite understand conflicts of interest here, do we? I
mean, not really.
In fact, they didn't take it down. Interestingly, they didn't take it down till Dacre was taken before the Leveson inquiry. Right. That week he took it down. Because it was part of the Leveson.
Why would they keep up for so long? Anyway, I mean, and let's not shy away ever talking the truth here. You own a wine bar.
Yeah, I do. Well, my daughter runs it. I sort of helped to set it up. Yeah, and I'm a director. I'm a co-director of the wine bar. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're not saying to the drinks industry you're evil personified. No. You're just saying we need to look at the way we consume alcohol.
Absolutely, that's exactly what I'm saying. If everyone just drank in bars, pubs, and wine bars. And we sat at the wine bar, by the way, because it was a safe space for women to drink.
Do women drink differently at different ages and do men drink differently at different ages?
Well, this is complicated, but there's
go on, uncomplicate it for me, Dave.
Right, so binging is common in both young men and women.
Yeah, binging's been around for a long time, hasn't it?
It's been around.
So I'm really good. I go to the gym, I work out all week, and then Friday comes along. But hey! Yeah.
Binging all your units in one weekend is worse than spreading them out.
Why is that?
Because the level of the toxicity relates to the concentration. The more you drink, the higher the concentration. That's the first thing.
Yeah, as you said earlier, you said the difference between maybe inhaling marijuana is it's into your system and then you're exhaling it out and it won't hang around so long. But if you drink a lot of alcohol through an evening, it's just staying in your system, recirculating.
Second thing it does is it causes inflammation. And inflammation is what begins to damage the brain. So we know that people who binge drink have more impaired brain function than people that drink the same amount but don't binge drink. Okay, that's known.
So bingers have more inflamed brains
than
the non-bingers.
That's right, yeah. And the third thing about the big risk about binging is that when you're really drunk, you can do stupid things like fall under a bus, fall under a train, and so you can die. And that is a very bad outcome.
Sadly, hurt yourself, permanently.
Yeah, you get break. Yeah, I mean,
people decide to jump off things, into things, in front of cars.
About 10 people a year in Britain die drunk, jumping into the sea from piers, thinking, not realizing that when they hit the cold water, their heart will stop. Drink makes you do really stupid things.
But other drugs make you do stupid things.
No, they don't. Not as much as alcohol. And cannabis definitely doesn't.
What about LSD? Doesn't that make you do silly things?
Rarely.
Really?
Oh, very rarely. I mean, it might make you think.
What about crack cocaine?
Things. Well, crack can make you do some silly things.
An epidemic that I witnessed in Brazil. I mean, the street filled. They were smoking what they call Pedro stones.
Yeah.
But one after the other, one after the other, and taking it with ecstasy. MDMA.
It is more dangerous than alcohol, crack cocaine. I'm not recommending.
And also the way that it hits and affects the brain, it's far more rapid.
Extremely fast, and
So we're having a competition about, I've seen more than you've seen. Now, I'm not. Well, you've definitely.
I've read more papers than you, but you've seen more of the reality.
Well, that's why alcohol gets a good rap, doesn't it? Because you can just go, well, look, he was doing that when he did that. Let's ban those awful drugs. Mm-hmm. But, they got into a pub fight, sort of somehow acceptable.
Absolutely. It's a hit mixture of historic use. It's a mixture of tradition. It's a mixture of lobbying. It's a mixture of all sorts of subtle pressure against other drugs and in favor of alcohol.
So they lobby against other legalization of other drugs, in particular to cannabis. Yeah.
Well, in America they do. I imagine it happens here, but at a less obvious level.
Yeah. And the Americans were the first people to sort of come up with prohibition.
Yes.
Was it ever muted historically here that we should ever have?
Yes, it was. There was an amazing election. I think it was probably about 1923.
23, so after the First World War.
The Americans, I think, were bringing it in. In Dundee, Winston Churchill stood against the temperance movement candidate.
Temperance movement were an anti-alcohol, religious.
And they destroyed Churchill.
Did they?
He got, I think the temperance guy got twice as many. Churchill got about 17,000 votes. The temperance guy got about 35. Yeah, the temperance movement in Britain almost got alcohol banned. Almost did. And it's actually, I'm glad they didn't. Because look what happened. I mean,
in America, it's just like everything. If you ban anything, it just goes underground. Then it becomes criminalized.
And worse, it creates criminal enterprises. There was organized crime did not exist till Prohibition in America. Mm. Prohibition basically made every single policeman corrupt because...
And a lot of law-abiding individuals corrupt because you went from saying I could go out and have a gin and tonic and now I have to drink it out of a teapot.
But they went into speakeasies. They went to speakeasies and every speakeasy had to be protected by the policeman. So every policeman was corrupt. So they had to create a special army of enforcers, Elliot Ness, the Untouchables, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
35,000 man army to take on organized crime. So when I say to politicians, well, all this thing about prohibiting drugs, do you think alcohol prohibition works? And they say, oh, no, that didn't work. Well, why would it be different for heroin, cocaine? Well, and they say, it's going to be different. Well, why is it? It's not. The point is, and the problem is, at one level, having created organized crime around drugs, we haven't been able to dismantle it.
Is alcohol easier to manage than, say, marijuana? If I was to smoke marijuana, I could probably grow it in my back garden or hydroponically. Mm-hmm. I could smoke it before I came to work. I'd be less likely to be found out. My breath wouldn't smell.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on how much I took or ingested or whatever it was. Is it because it's harder to detect that it's banned? Because, you can put someone on a breathalyzer at work. I suppose you could put them on THC monitor.
You can test people. I mean, this is one of the outrageous things they're doing in terms of roadside testing. So they're testing. If you get stopped now, the police in many parts will test your saliva for a range of drugs.
Mm.
Well, if you test positive for alcohol, the threshold is 80, right?
Mm.
Which is actually a threshold which does impair you. So it's perfectly reasonable to stop you driving over that. But they've set the thresholds for other drugs at about a tenth of what impairs you.
Right.
So people are getting prosecuted all the time.
So you could not be affected or impaired by the taking of a certain drug, but you'll be convicted for taking it because it's an illegal drug?
Exactly. And it's I think it's outrageous. They're using drug testing to try to stop people using drugs, even though they know it's not impairing their driving. I think it's another one of these oppressive decisions that the last government made just to try to punish people for using illegal drugs.
I was in Belmarsh prison recently and I was they've got a massive issue, as all prisons have across the United Kingdom now, with spice.
Absolutely.
Right, because it's dirt cheap, you can get it in easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's often doesn't smell that much. Mm-hmm. So you can smoke it away in your cell and no one knows you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's very profitable if you're a drug dealer.
Super.
Yeah. And there's so many different models and types.
Absolutely.
Out there. So if you ban one molecular formula, you make another one and you can put it on a bit of paper so big, which is like less than my thumbnail, and that would go for like £5 to £10 in prison.
Absolutely.
Three times or four times its street value.
Absolutely.
So I inhaled what was the residue of a vape while I was there, given to me by a prison officer on camera. And I can only describe, as I'm not often lost for words, but I was at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was told what I was smoking was something called Man Down.
Mm-hmm.
And it does exactly what it says on the side of the tin. Jumph, right? Mm. And what I was told it was, and I was told this by the person that smoked it the next day when I knocked on his cell, because he had told me to go forth and multiply out of his cell at the time that he realized I was there with the film crew. In between, given citrus, actually. Do you know that they say that citrus knocks off the immediate effects of smoking spice? And they have no. So you'll see what they'll do. The first thing they'll do is give them some lemon or orange, generally. It'll just knock off the original massive hit of the first smoke of spice, or whatever you want to call it, the inhalation of spice. And he couldn't recognize me. I couldn't say a word for a couple of seconds to the camera. The next day he knocked on his door, didn't know that I'd ever been in his cell, wanting to know why I was doing in the prison, why was I there. And he said to me, I smoke it because it takes me 3 or 4 days to get over it. And that means I'm 3 or 4 days I'm not in prison, right? Yeah, so he's using it as a complete exit drug, yeah?
Absolutely.
But he told me what it was. He said, it's a mixture of aluminium cleaner and cockroach killer. So how are those chemicals, who works out that the chemicals that are in cockroach killer and aluminium cleaner are similar or have the same effect mm-hmm. as something that was originally based on THC, was it not?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? I'm no position to understand that, are you?
Well, cockroach killers are chemicals.
Yeah.
And
I get that bit.
Yep.
And but why would they
have aluminium cleaner will be probably an acid.
Yeah.
And the two together will probably react to produce some volatile chemical that
resembles spice or is yeah. spice? Well, does it matter what spice is? Is spice, can you say one thing? There are two types, aren't there?
No.
Shall we start from come on, let's think spice.
Let's have a look. Okay.
So spice up your life.
Once upon a time.
There's nothing to joke about me saying that, I have to say.
Once upon a
but
time.
But it is something that people were shouting at me from the prison after they found out that I'd inhaled it. Yeah. Yeah.
So we used to have cannabis, you know, yeah. when I was a student, you know, it was resin or herbal. It was, you know, 5% THC, 3% cannabidiol coming from Morocco, or if you're lucky, from Lebanon. Everything was fine. Then we decided to get hard on cannabis back in the kind of 90s, start controlling it because the Americans decided it was their number one problem.
What, marijuana?
Yeah.
I do know one thing, actually. I was out, with the DEA out on the border in Arizona, and they had what I can only describe as, you know, the scene in Raiders from the Lost Ark where the Ark of the Covenant is in the corner and
yeah.
they pull back?
Yeah.
It was a room like that, and it was bale after bale after bale of people who'd made it across from Mexico, right, been nabbed, sent back or deported back after being chained there mm-hmm. and to the feet. And there was bales and bales and bales. Because if you get it across and you get it to a dealer, you're actually allowed to stay with the dealer, or the dealer will put you on a chain uh-huh. to stay inside the country as a legal immigrant. If you right. get caught, of course, yeah. ain't happening. But, you know, you risk death crossing that desert.
Yeah, yeah.
But they had a massive incinerator there. Mm. And every week they burnt nearly, I think it was like, 4 tons to 5 tons of marijuana. Mm. Marijuana doesn't weigh a lot. That's a lot of marijuana. Mm. And they reduced it into a little block, like an OXO cube, the, you know, the size of a Rubik cube, and go, hey, we just got rid of all that marijuana. I have to say, the staff seem quite happy to work there.
Well, you often see them downwind, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. And also, ludicrously, because of the odd words, the way that America breaks down between state, you know, municipal police, sheriff's department, one of the sheriffs on the border in another part of Mexico, on the Juarez border, which is a very dangerous passing. I spent a lot of time there and saw the damage that drugs do in terms of violence. Four people getting shot on the hour every hour, right? People being skinned, people being decapitated.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty awful things to witness. All over drugs. Mm-hmm. All over drugs, manufacturing drugs and getting drugs across into the biggest market in the world. But there was a sheriff on the other side that owned nine trailer trucks. Why did he need 9 trailer trucks as a sheriff? What was he putting in?
A bit on the side.
What was he putting? Sand? From the desert cactus? He was
aloe.
Yeah, a big collection of aloe vera. Anyway, that's another story.
But you exempt. No, hang on. So that story is interesting because you pointed out it's very easy to stop the movement of marijuana because it's big.
And also, sorry, the point of my conversation was this. They said the only time that their officers, the Drug Enforcement Administration officers, had been killed was when they started spraying the crops of marijuana. Because if you're a crack addict, right, you're only good for 3 or 4 years. If you're a tweaker, 2 to 3 years, if you smoke crystal meth, right? All of which are being manufactured in Mexico. Yeah. So the cartels have control of that. But if you smoke marijuana, you could be a judge, you could be a copper, you could be a doctor, you could be a road sweeper, you could be any other thing, and you're there for a long time. Absolutely. You're a captive audience for a very, very long time. So that was the only time that their officers started getting hit.
Yeah.
That's what I was told anyway.
That's perfectly credible. So we got quite successful in stopping cannabis coming in from overseas. So what happened?
We started growing it,
you know, on their own,
in the roofs.
That's right.
Roof spaces. Using Vietnamese kids,
Now, on the street in Britain, 95% of what you buy is skunk. It's THC of 12% upwards, right?
And what should it be naturally? Do you know?
Well, yeah, but I mean, the traditionally sort of 4 to 6% THC, but but with CBD, so it's increased three times the strength, but you've lost the CBD. The CBD, the cannabidiol, is protective, so skunk is more addictive and makes you more crazy. Okay,
so that's it can have effect on your mental health.
That's the first problem. The second problem was that for some reason, no one really understands where this came from. It was never discussed with the prison governors, but they decided to start testing for drugs in prison. Mm. I suspect there was a minister that was probably looking for a job in a testing company when he got sacked. I don't know, just a suspicion. And the decision was made, let's start testing prisoners. Now, you smoke a spliff, the cannabis will be detected for a month. And prisoners suddenly worked out that they were being caught for having smoked a spliff.
But heroin leaves your system very, very quickly.
What did they do? The first thing the prisoners did, they switched to heroin. And then they tried to switch to pregabalin, the prescription drug. But then it became harder to get those. So then someone had a clever idea. Well, why don't you smoke spice? So spice is a generic term for synthetic cannabinoids. So they're new molecules that act like super strong THC, but which are sprayed onto spice.
Sprayed onto like bits of anything, a bit greeny.
Anything that's green. You spray it onto that, and then you started off smoking it like it was that was cannabis. Mm. But then people realize you don't need to spray it on things. You just soak your new paper in it.
It gums in letters. And it's,
absolutely.
But also the problem with that is I was told by, this is when I was in Barlinnie prison in Scotland, is it depends where, if they've hung it up to dry, all the liquid drops to the bottom.
That's right.
So you're with your co-pilot in your prison, and you and I have decided to have, we've got a little bit, but my bit comes from up here and I go first. I smoke mine. I'm absolutely fine. You smoke yours, but it came off the end of this bit of paper, the bottom bit where all the liquid soaked to the bottom, and it's 12 and 20 times stronger.
Absolutely.
And you're ODing, or that's you're, right. You know, you're passed out and you're gone.
Possibly. But what's worse is that the first synthetic cannabinoids actually had been made and tested in humans back in the 1970s.
So the legal highs?
Never been legal. But they were never marketed. They were made to be super cannabis medicines for things like nausea, but they were never marketed. Why?
So originally they were pharmaceuticals.
They were pharmaceuticals. And they weren't marketed because they were so horrible. When they gave them to people to test, hated them. And then the government decided, well, we're going to ban these first generation so-called synthetic cannabinoids.
But they were being sold in garages. You could go and buy it in a garage, couldn't you? Yeah, you could buy it in a sweet shop.
They hadn't been formally made illegal. That's true. I mean, but then we were made illegal, right?
Mm, yeah.
And then the second generation came along. But the second generation had never been tested in humans. They'd just been tested in rats.
And this was coming from China?
These were all pharma companies, but they were being remade in China.
Yeah, yeah.
So the government banned those. And then the third generation have just been invented based on chemical structure. So the first exposure of these new compounds to any life form are in prisoners. Yeah,
yeah,
it's just absolutely ridiculous. And it's all because we're obsessed with stopping prisoners smoking cannabis. In the Netherlands, they don't care. They don't test prisoners. Well, if a prisoner's stoned, it's much easier to everyone to get by. But we have created the monster of spice because we are obsessed with punishing people.
Let's go back to alcohol. The size of the glasses have changed.
They have indeed.
You go into, they don't ask this, do you want a glass of wine? And then suddenly this fish bowl turns up.
That's right.
With like, you know.
It's a third of a pint, a third of a bottle. A large is a third of a bottle.
And do you know how quickly, if you're a Moorish and you're having a good time, that's...
And that is why they shouldn't be sold like that. So when I was starting to drink wine, it was only 125ml glasses, and those were the standards.
So just to give you an idea, that's about this, isn't it?
Yeah, if someone serves you a 125ml glass, you think your beer ripped off. But in fact, most places don't tell you what that's... By law, they should, but most bars don't tell you the price of 125. Most people say, do you want a larger...
Medium.
A medium. But in fact,
You could ask, I'd have a small,
you
please.
Can, and they must, by law, serve you a small. But we've got so... inured to the expanding size of wine glasses, that a small looks almost a joke, and that's a problem. We've got to shift that back.
We're sort of being conned, aren't we? We're sort of being controlled.
We are being controlled. Absolutely, we're being subtly manipulated by an industry that spends hundreds of millions of pounds a year telling you how wonderful alcohol is.
How much money are they making, though?
Well, the drinks industry is the most profitable industry Because, I mean, alcohol's so cheap to make. I mean, obviously, they pay a lot of tax.
So, okay, come on, here we go. This is going to get people going. Going to get me angry. Get me angry, Dave. How much money does it cost to produce a can of lager, then?
About 2p.
How much do they sell a can of lager for?
Well, say a pound.
That's a lot of profit.
Which is. Is it... This is, yes, absolutely. Not, it's ridiculously easy to make money selling booze. I mean, obviously, they've got a lot of advertising and marketing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of tax. But it's a ridiculously easy market to make money in.
So the main cost to the producers of alcohol in this country is tax.
Yeah, that's right.
No wonder you got sacked from, you were asked to resign. I mean, you sound so onside. I'll tell you what, I read the notes for this interview. I went back, I went to through Paddington, as I will, not every night, I hasten to add, not go through Paddington. I went to Marks and Spencer's, bought myself my, my pasta dish or whatever it may be, and also took a cheeky bottle of Pinot Noir.
The tiny bottle, I hope.
No, the large one, trust me. And as I read the notes on the train, the bottle in my backpack became more and more and more unattractive to me, I have to say. So if you said, drink your book, what is the ultimate message inside the book?
Oh, very straightforward. The ultimate message is think about drinking. Don't drink reflexly. Don't drink because everyone else is drinking. Don't drink because you've always drunk. Sit down and have a mature conversation with yourself about what you're drinking, why you're drinking it, and whether the benefits you get from drinking outweigh the harms. And the harms are in there. You can compute the harms to you at your level of drinking, and you can make that decision.
Dave, Professor Nutt, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Ross.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Kempcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can find me on Twitter at Ross Kemp and on Instagram at Ross Kemp TV. This has been a Freshwater and the Chancellor Collective production. Thanks to the team and one fine play. And until the next episode, goodbye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.